Well, there you go, Nina. A little bit of audio medicine for our listeners. Great story, great initiative, great task force, a lot of good things that Major Bel Castro is doing. And the thing that we talked about kind of offline was, you know, what freedom meant to her. And she said it's freedom means for people to be able to do what they were meant to do. And where else but in America? But, you know, what she's done, and you said it so eloquently, sticking to her guns, persevering in a man's world, whatever that means. I'll probably have somebody send me something, some hate mail or something. But no, but seriously, she has done some incredible work. She's helped thousands of ladies everywhere to get through some pretty traumatic times.
Oh, for sure. Just her intuition of recognizing that there was a problem there and going out and doing something about it, no matter, you know, as she said, rogue, no matter what anybody thought, she just saw that there was a need and went out and to do it. And it had such an impact within the military as well as for those women outside. And once they get out, you know, it has an impact for the rest of their lives. And the fact that she can recognize that and help them in the recovery state and as well as try to prevent it from happening altogether is just significant. And I, you know, the programs that she started, I can see happening everywhere. I mean, we need it beyond military, but.
Absolutely. And, you know, so there you go. So Inner Boots program, it's innerboots.org and it's Task Force SASA, Tango, so Foxtrot, Sierra. Yeah.
Task Force SASA is her lead, is the parent company.
Right.
So the two programs that you could find are In Her Boots program and then the Combat Boots Jewelry Collection. So those both programs you can find on Facebook.
Pleased to have had Major Bel Castro on Straight Outta Combat Radio. Really pleased to have you as my co-host. Thank you.
You're welcome. Thank you. It was quite a bit of fun, and I enjoyed and was so inspired by what she did. And so how awesome that she was our first interviewee as me on the show.
Awesome. Thank you very much. God bless.
Your steely-eyed killer shadow in the night. You were born to fight.
Welcome to Straight Outta Combat Radio, audio medicine by Green Zone Hero, where we honor freedom to improve business.
Straight Outta Combat Radio is the platform, the voice for veterans to share their personal stories, and we honor their wisdom. And we want to diminish the negative stereotypes of veterans.
My name is John Krotek. I'm a U.S. Army veteran, and I was an NBC NCO.
And I'm Nina Herman, U.S. Army veteran, and I was a finance officer.
We have a very, very, very special guest today on this episode of Straight Outta Combat Radio. I would like to say that this is our first episode in the new format, and it's going to be exciting and a lot of fun. We're going to tell a lot of interesting stories of our veterans, male and female, and they're going to tell us stories of hope and inspiration. And our guest today is somebody that I met in Dallas last year. She's a phenomenal United States Army officer, major, retired, airborne. We're going to hear more about that. Her name is Lisa Bel Castro. She was an engineer. She has 20 years of active military service in and out of combat theater, and my co-host today, for the first time ever in the world, is also an Army officer. She was in finance, a little bit different from engineering, and she was a captain. Hey, Nina.
Hello.
So I'm just thrilled to death. You know, this is a great place for me to be, and, you know, anytime I can be surrounded by combat veterans or, you know, just officers and especially female type that actually have such great courage and are such great inspiration to ladies in uniform everywhere. I just got to say that it touches my soul and touches my heart, and I'm thrilled to death to have both of you here with me today.
Thank you.
Awesome, John. And it's an honor to be on here with you as well, Major.
Thank you. It's an honor to be able to speak with y'all about, you know, what we're still doing even after we left the military and still trying to impact results in the military.
Absolutely. And Nina's going to tell the listening folks out there a little bit about you. And then I'm excited to hear the story, the little bit that we heard off recording. Phenomenal work you're doing, Major. And wow, whatever we can do to help spread the word. But let's learn a little bit about her, Nina. Tell us a little bit about the Major.
Absolutely. Major retired Lisa Bel Castro Bass served in the U.S. Army from 1992 to 2012. She began her career as a 30-year-old single parent of three at the rank of private in the Judge Advocate Corps, JAG. She attended Officer Candidate School and was commissioned as Engineer Officer at her seventh year serving in the Army. As a grandmother, she attended Airborne School and became the first female commander in the 173rd Airborne Brigade Combat Team. She served two 12-month tours in Iraq. On her last deployment, she founded Task Force SASA, which stands for Task Force Sisterhood Against Sexual Assault, and developed In Her Boots program. Upon retirement in 2012, Lisa quickly jumped into entrepreneurship by continuing her construction company, LR General Solutions, that she started while on active duty, and incorporating Task Force SASA LLC.
Awesome. Welcome, Major.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
Well, the first thing that stands out to me, and a grandmother at Airborne School. I mean, how in the world does that happen? That's awesome.
Yeah. Actually, you know, I was a platoon leader at the time, and I was watching my soldiers get picked up for Airborne School. We were at Fort Benning. I was stationed at Fort Benning, Georgia. And so, you know, we've seen all the airborne training. We're right next to it. And then my soldiers started getting picked up and going. And I'm like, you know, I outrun these guys. So, you know, I'm going to try this. Now, the whole comical thing about it is I was scared of heights. Not even my kids rode Ferris wheels growing up because I was definitely scared of heights. And so, you know, it was facing that fear. You know, the military is about facing your fear. And so I went over to my NCO, my training NCO, and I was like, hey, I want to get enrolled in airborne school. And they were like, ma'am, if you're crazy enough to do this at your age, we'll get you in. And I actually had to have a Fulbert colonel sign off on the paperwork. But I got in and completed it.
Was that like a three-week school?
It is. It is. I had went to officer candidate school there, so I was very, and being stationed there, I was very familiar with the terrain and what was going on. I could tell the time in airborne school by the beats of the drum and OCS. So that kind of helped out and took a lot of the mental stuff off because I knew what was going on. So I just had to focus on my physical part of it.
So you're originally from Texas?
I am. I was born in Houston, but I was actually raised in Alabama.
You know, when I was driving through Texas, actually a few times, these signs are bumper stickers that says don't mess with Texas.
Don't mess with Texas.
What's the deal with that?
Well, you know, we all have guns, right?
I knew there was a backstory to that, so that's pretty cool. But
we don't play. I mean, I remember my grandmother when I was little saying Texas could be its own country.
Absolutely. I think you almost succeeded a few times from the Union, something like that. Went in the military at 30. What did you do before that?
I was a high school dropout and a single parent of three by the time I was 22. And so I went several times. I literally went three times to the recruiter trying to get in because it was just something I was compelled. I loved. We had an Air Force duty station next to me, and I would always see those airmen, and I was like, oh, man, I want to be a part of something bigger than myself. And so I knew if that would be a great way to take care of my kids, but also fulfill something that was deep desire in me. I'm very patriotic. I believe in my country. And so, you know, the first time I went to the recruiter, they were like, no, because you don't have a high school education. So I went, got a GED, and then I took some courses. And then the second time it was because I was a single parent. And so I went on and got picked up in a pilot program at Auburn University that could high school dropouts complete college. And so I jumped on that, and I had some guys in my class that were on the GI Bill. And I was telling them I wanted to be in the military, and they said, well, go back to the recruiters now. They're taking anybody. I said, okay. And I did, and I went through, and I got selected because I had all the education. I did not give up my kids. I always maintained custody of my kids. And literally when I got to my first duty station working for JAG, the attorneys were like, okay, How'd you join the Army with three kids? And I said, God opened the garage door, and we all went running through. So that was the beginning of my career.
I love it. So John mentioned don't mess with Texas. I would say don't mess with Major Bass.
Yeah, absolutely. What was basic training like for you, and where did you go to basic?
I went to basic training at Fort Leonard Wood, Missouri. It was comical. We got, you know, in the cattle truck. They make you do a push-up when you get in the cattle truck, drive across the railroad tracks, and then they start yanking you off. And all these females were crying because back then I went through when it was just all females within my company. All these young ladies were crying, and I'm looking around going, okay, this is not hard. What's going on? But at the same time, I thought, what have I gotten myself into? It was actually... Basic wasn't bad for me. I mean, I think because of the maturity level already, I already had three kids. My oldest son was already 13 when I joined. So I'd already seen a lot of life anyway. So it wasn't that bad for me.
That's pretty neat. You know, and I think it's kind of funny that you say, you know, it wasn't that bad for you because you were a little bit older. I actually was a little bit older when I went in. I was 26 myself. I can remember the cattle car, and I do remember that. It was like, holy cow, what have I gotten myself into? Especially when the drill sergeants were running up and down the aisles in the auditorium, you know, talking about what makes the grass grow and all this. And I'm like, you know, I could be back on the block. What am I doing here? But America offers us these opportunities, and, you know, your willingness to raise your right hand. And, you know, you said you always had this desire to serve. It just, you know, it gives me freaking goosebumps. So I'm glad we had somebody like you.
It was the right time, I guess.
What comes to mind is, did you ever see the movie Your Mom in Combat Boots?
I have not seen that.
With, is that, oh no. I was thinking the Goldie Hawn ones.
I think it is. Maybe.
What? No, that was Stripes, I think. The Goldie Hawn, wasn't it?
I'm not sure. No, I'd have to look it up.
That's Bill Murray.
But those movies are great.
I remember watching it in like the 80s or maybe early 90s, I don't know, but that was like my first, really, I can't even believe I'm admitting this, but that was like my, maybe one day I'll end up in the Army. So you, as soon as I'm listening to your story and reading your bio, I'm like, wow, she's like the living proof of it.
Absolutely.
And if you look back, you'll see things in your life that set up the conditions without you even knowing. I watched MASH growing up. And so I didn't realize how much of an impact that had on me because I didn't have military influence around me. So it was just something. My grandmother was very patriotic. She actually did work for the War Department back in World War II, not actually part of the WAC, but donated her time and stuff. And ironically, I was a drafter before I came in the military. And so she actually taught soldiers how to read engineer plans. And I thought, how wild was that? I didn't discover that until after she passed away and I was going through her documents. Hmm. But the ironic thing, when I joined, they wouldn't let me come in as a drafter. They said that was closed off for females. And then 7 years later, I become an engineer and I was in charge of the drafters. So I thought
awesome.
That was
pretty
cool. Like full circle. You know what's really cool about the story, though, is, you know, you saw the enlisted side and the officer side and also the command side. And, you know, through the eyes of a female, what was that like from permanent duty station, your first duty station into combat, and also the transition from the enlisted role into the command officer role? You know, that's a unique exposure.
It is. I am glad I did it that way because being enlisted for 7 years and being JAG, my first duty station was at Fort Ord, California, and I worked for Trial Defense Service. And I will never forget because we were on F Avenue. And so my saying would be like, yeah, if you know, effing up, you're going to end up in our office. But as a private, I got firsthand experience of what you can do and what you can't do in the military, what's acceptable and what's not. So I've seen a lot of cases, and I just thought, and a lot of guys just wanted to get out. And I'm thinking, well, there's not much in the civilian world. But coming up through the ranks and working on court martials and seeing what goes on from that aspect, it did two things for me as an officer. One, as an officer, I was a better planner for my soldiers. when it came to operation orders or what I wanted to happen in a mission, I always made sure my philosophy was you take care of the soldiers first. I mean, housing, finances, and everything. They will always take care of the mission. And so I always made sure that was in place. And if I had, you know, unfortunately, an NCO that wasn't doing the job, I would get rid of them. And I would be told, hey, ma'am, you're the first that's ever done that. But, you know, I wasn't going to put up with anything. And as a commander, when I had that authority to put somebody out or court-martial and to retain them still on active duty after they got sent away, I had that power, and I knew not to just listen to the judge advocate on, hey, just sign here, because I was in control of that person's career. And so a lot of guys stepped on it royally, but it didn't mean they were learning. So they didn't need to get kicked out. They needed to serve some time, but they didn't need to get kicked out. And because of my experience enlisted in the JAG Corps, I knew what blocks to check, regardless of what anybody was telling me or advising me, to save that career of that soldier. Because it was about the soldier and the mission, not because somebody wanted somebody off their books or something. So I really, really am grateful for that experience. Actually, when I transferred from officer candidate school, I mean, from enlisted officer, the first time I applied for OCS, I wasn't selected. And I was in shock. You talk about full humbleness. I worked at 3 Corps at Fort Hood, Texas. And I'll be honest, I worked with nothing but females. And those kind that give females a bad name in the military. And so I finished my bachelor's degree, applied for OCS, went to the board, and did not get selected. And so now here I am in front of those females that tried to block me the whole time. You know, there was no support there. And I talk about, I deal with that in the Inner Boots program. But, you know, I had to eat my pie of humbleness. And I ended up PCSing to Germany. As I was in processing, I noticed that there was a selection board again for OCS.
Now, you were an E7 at the time?
No, I was an E5.
E5.
And so when I photocopied my packet while I was in processing, because I had a letter from a 3-star general, you know, from Fort Hood, Texas, that was recommending me for OCS, but I didn't get picked up. And I photocopied my packet and went to my battalion commander, who had never seen me, never met me. And I said, sir, I'm trying to apply for OCS. I have a letter of recommendation from a 3-star. Can you make your recommendation off of his? And so, of course, he did. And I photocopied my packet, submitted it, went to the board. So, you know, they're looking at me and they're like, okay, we see you applied for OCS and didn't get selected the first time. Do you know why? And I said, yes. They told me I was too old. And I was 34 at the time. And so, but I read the regulations. See, the regulation's key.
Yeah.
Doesn't matter what anybody tells you. It's what's in writing. And I had 1 year. I had to be commissioned by 35 is what it said. Well, I wasn't 35 yet. So I looked at the board members and I'm like, you know, so I'm applying again, different needs of the Army, rules change, you know, different leadership. And I, at that point, I did want to look back and ask what if. So I gave it a try and I did. I asked the board. I said, what's the worst they're going to tell me? No, I've heard that before. And so I walked out of there and really did not think anything of it. I just kind of was like, you know, I'm just doing it because I never wanted to look back and go, what if? Probably a couple of months later, I was at a German fest and broke my ankle. I fell off the curb and broke my ankle. And it was like, oh, so now I'm in a cast up to my knee and trying to walk around. So I went to the board probably in about March. September, I get this call. I had just gotten the cast off from my S1 saying, hey, Sergeant, you got selected. And I literally said, selected for what? And she was like, OCS, you got selected. I mean, I kid
awesome.
You not. I was in shock. The only response was no shit, you know.
the best response you could have right there.
Yeah, but the whole comical thing about it, and I just say God was all over. His hands were just all over this, because when I got selected, the orders came down from Department of the Army, right? And now I'm in Germany, which falls under PERSCOM. Well, apparently, PERSCOM didn't want to release me, that I should not have applied because I had not served 2/3 of my contract in Germany.
Mm-hmm. It's always
something. And I was like, well, you know, I got orders from Department of the Army. So I was only in Germany 10 months, and they turned around and brought me back because they had to get me into officer candidate school before I turned 35. They had to get me commissioned. So here I'm now going with an ankle that's not healed yet. But going back before that happened, within that 10 months as an NCO there, we had issues with the master sergeant and sexual harassment issues. And because we were JAG, you know, I brought it to the senior level, keeping it in-house, which, you know, I look back and I go, oh, I shouldn't have done that. But, I mean, really back then you didn't speak of things in the 90s. And so I went, tried to keep it in-house. Of course, they just, you know, slapped his hands and everything. Well, he made it very difficult for me. What he was trying to do is put me in a position that, because I have this issue with my mouth, and so I used to say, wow, you know, I used to get in trouble with my mouth as a private, and then they went and commissioned me. So then it was all over with. But he was trying to get it where, you know, if I disrespected him, anything for grounds for an Article 15, because that would pull my OCS packet. And so it was really a time where I had to dig deep to keep my mouth shut. KMS is, and we talk about that in the program. But finally, I just had to call the first sergeant over in Heidelberg. I was in Mannheim, and my first sergeant brought me over and stuff. But when they presented me my award, it was a picture of Turley Barracks, and it literally said, "Bets are on that you will not make it through OCS." And my first sergeant let that master sergeant walk out, and he looked at me, and he said, "Everywhere you go, you hang that picture. So when soldiers come in and talk to you, you can point at that picture and go, I know what you're going through." And he said, and then when you come across NCOs like that, he said, get rid of them.
Absolutely.
And I, yeah. I was very true to that.
Well, that, you know, the seeds were sown for your task force initiative right there then, it sounds like.
It was. It did. It started there. It really did.
Just listening to your story, just the perseverance and the what you have overcome, you've had such an impact in the military, and then what you've been able to do since then is just, it gives me goosebumps. It's a story that you don't hear very often, but your story is just so amazing. So it's such an honor to have you here on our radio and be able to tell us about it and share it and be able to have an impact even further.
Absolutely. Couldn't have said it better myself. Now we both have goosebumps. I'm not sure if the major does, but
yeah,
I know we do, but tell us about a little bit about combat, but we really want to get to your task force and Inner Boots program. But, you know, tell us a little bit about combat. And, you know, here's Vernina, and you can, you know, trade notes, because I know she was in the Green Zone in Baghdad.
Well, I went in OIF-2, and this is when I was geared up to go in OIF-1. And so they pulled our orders, and I went on to the captain's career course. And then from there, when I came out of the captain's career course, went to Germany, and then went on to OIF-2. We rolled in 3 days in the desert. I mean, there's no 7-Eleven to stop to use the restroom or anything. So, I mean, literally, I was in a 27-vehicle convoy going through the desert with the camels running next to us. And I was next to the last vehicle. And I remember I sat in the back because I was tiny. And one of our master sergeants, he was a big guy. And there was just no way he was going to be able to sit in the back of the MV. So I let him sit up front because I was cool sitting in the back. But I would be like, oh, man, I got to go. I got to go. And they were like, oh, ma'am, you know, use the bottle. And I'm like, no. Because I'm in with the guys and stuff. And I said, just stop the damn vehicle, you know. So we would just stop in the middle of the desert, and I'd pull the gun truck that was behind us up. And, you know, I kid you not, I was even thinking, what am I doing here? I'm a grandmother, for crying out loud.
What year was that? When was that?
This was 2003, you know, then I jumped back in the vehicle. But the guys loved it because then we would haul ass to catch up with the rest of the convoy. So they really, you know, they got to floor the vehicle and do all that kind of crazy stuff in the desert trying to catch up. Yeah, we ended up rolling into Baghdad. We were trying to get to Tikrit. I was with 1st Infantry Division, and we actually broke down. What it was, my driver caught, it was a truck, couple of trucks up, and we seen the wheel kind of moving off, like it was about to, it wasn't going to blow, it was just going to come off the rim, right? So we pulled up next to him, and we were like, stop the truck. Well, when we did, it left us with 4 vehicles. The rest of the convoy kept going. We're in first time we seen city, anybody. And we caused huge traffic mess up. I mean, it was market day in Baghdad. And, you know, like I said, this is 2003. So I brought my perimeter out. Of course, I'm the senior ranker, and I just BCS'd into the unit. So these guys really didn't know me. You know, I pulled the perimeter in. We're like, oh, my God. So get the guys out. It was the freaking maintenance truck whose tire was about to come off. So go figure in the military, right? And so, you know, we secure the perimeter, get these guys on it. And we had intel that, you know, these Iraqis were coming in with, like, holding bags, and they would just walk in on you and blow themselves up and stuff. And we had an incident where, you know, the Iraqi comes in. I mean, it was full description of the intel that we had gotten. So the first time, you know, here I am with a loaded weapon on green, and I had an M16 at the time. And I put that thing in the between that guy's eyes and backed him right on out of our perimeters. I mean, it was scary. It's like, you know, what are you going to do? He goes the other way. We're trying to get this tire fixed because everybody else left us. And the next thing I know, the MPs drive up. I had never been so excited to see the MPs before in my life.
Yeah, and, really.
And so the guy gets out. I remember I probably came up to his elbow. These were really, you know, they really picked those guys to be the MPs on those roads. So we started hearing some gunfire. He was like, hey, ma'am, we got to go check this out. You know, look, there was a wall. We could see over the wall. He's like, we got to go over the wall and check this out. He's like, y'all are going to have to be our backup. And I was like, oh, my God. You know, we are down deep and stuff. But I remember asking the guy, I said, if you need us, what do you want me to say when we're coming over and stuff? He said, ma'am, just yell. We'll all know it's you. And I was like, okay. So that was a pretty stressful time. We got back, and I remember when I set the gun truck up, the kid, he was a specialist. He had a 9mm. We had a Mark 19. I'm like, dude, what are you doing? Get behind the Mark 19. He goes, ma'am, it doesn't work. That commander had let us roll out without making sure all the weapons were working. And wow. I mean, I was just like, oh, my God. I said, good night. I said, they don't know it doesn't work. Get behind the Mark 19, you know? But we finally got it squared away and out of there. But that was a trip. It was trying to even just get to Tikrit. But just that full, as an engineer, we were over there to build the airfields up to bring folks over, you know? So that was the first deployment, pretty much. I actually ended up, I was the adjutant for the brigade commander. We ended up filling in for the division commander and would drag me through. But I was responsible for writing the letters home to the parents. I remember writing for 21 soldiers under our command. Hmm. Only one was not the age of my kids. And that was tough.
I would imagine so. And yeah, I mean, it is tough duty. And those are the things that you don't really, that people don't talk about or sometimes don't remember or don't want to remember. And there is the high cost of one of the subjects we want to talk about today, which is freedom. And so that was your first deployment. And
that was.
You basically all built airstrips around Tikrit or all over Iraq?
Well, it was just to get in the FOB areas. We were in charge mainly, though, of route clearance. And so I remember us being out there. I mean, our Humvees weren't even up armored. Okay, so, you know, this is sandbags and putting metal on it. We were not ready to go in. We just got the guy dumped. Because why? We trained, you know, during those years, we had trained for Vietnam. You know, I remember digging foxholes and, you know, sleeping out in the woods in Fort Benning all the time. That was my first, you know, 10 years of training. And then all of a sudden we're deployed in a whole different environment. So it was definitely learning on the spot for all of us. But I remember we were having folks from home send us remote control cars because we would be out there trying to figure out, you know, how are we going to save these guys from this route clearance? Because all these IEDs were going off, you know? So just at that level, you know, that's where a lot of that came in. That you see nowadays is from what we were developing when we first hit ground over there.
So I think, you know, most of the casualties in Iraq were IEDs, weren't they?
Yes.
Yeah. So then when did you leave that first deployment and get back? Did you come back to the States?
No, back to Germany.
And
so
what,
I went back to...
What'd you do? You just refit and then went right back out again?
No, I went to Bamberg. Well, that was the duty station for First ID. And First ID at that time when we came back, it wasn't so much about resetting. They were closing up shop in Germany and moving to back to the States. And so I ended up taking command in the 82nd Engineer Battalion. Engineer Blue Babes is what it was called. It's a very historical unit. But then they deactivated it. So we closed it down. Because I was the commander there and the 173rd was moving in, and hence I was airborne, that was, everybody wanted that command. They wanted a command in the elite 173rd. And so I ended up competing, and I was handpicked by a two-star general to take that slot because he knew that being the first on the ground, we were bringing in three battalions that were non-existent yet. And but I had to compete against my fellow engineer buddies who had, ironically had been in, you know, tanks. They were combat engineers, so they were ground soldiers, so they didn't have their airborne wings. And that was kind of a criteria to be in an airborne unit. Of course, they were saying they'd take people, we would send them to airborne school. But I ended up beating them all out for that command. So that was pretty cool. But what we did is push First ID out and then stood up the 173rd in Bamberg. The issue was I was 6 months there. I was the only unit with a Maroon Beret. And Department of the Army just started sending people and filling these slots. Well, I didn't have a battalion commander. The battalion commander was with First ID. He was leaving, and our battalion commander hasn't, and none of the battalion commanders had came in. So I literally absorbed all the property for three battalions. Hmm. Every soldier that would come in, they'd just show up at my door, and I would be like, okay, you know, I'd look at the, it'd be to a whole nother unit, but they didn't exist. And I was like, how, why are you here at my unit? They go, you're the only one with Maroon Berets around here. I was like, okay. So I just started taking them in. And I mean, I got upwards to like, you know, 400 or 500 soldiers before we got commands into the other units where these guys were supposed to go to. So it was pretty, it was for standing it up, very unique opportunity. I was picked by a two-star general. I was the first female airborne commander for their, organization, but it was something that they weren't really prepared for. I mean, when my brigade commander came in, I was told I was taking one of his boys' slots, and he didn't like it. Hmm. And as I tell my battalion commander, he didn't put me in this position, and he's not taking me out. I knew what my timeline was, and I held true.
That's good that you did.
Awesome. Hands down, I would have picked you.
Thanks.
Yeah, I know you sisters hang together, but that's good. That's what it's all about. And I think we need to get really more to the mission of what you're doing now. We can talk a little bit about the second deployment, you know, because I know there was a huge difference. I know you might have told me some of that in Dallas, what it was like. We want to hear about the very important mission that we talked about at the outset. That's a very critical initiative. And it's a story that needs to be told, and we need to start the education. And you've been doing a hell of a job of it for a while, which is Task Force SASA, Sisterhood Against Sexual Assault.
Well, it actually did start during the second deployment. That's where the it really got the momentum, and they really the mission came from there. I worked at the J7 USFI headquarters, and so. Toward the end, my actual responsibility was I wrote the policies to draw down all our construction efforts in Iraq so we didn't leave any unfinished projects for the Iraqis to say, look what the Americans left behind. So it was about strapping those commanders financially.
Yeah.
because everybody wants to put their mark in the sand when their unit's there. But, you know, these policies were coming down, and the one that just really got me was, if I wore my reflective belt, I wouldn't be raped. And I was like, who is coming up with this crap? I mean, come on. If you're wearing your reflective belt and you come up behind, you know, from behind a T-wall, and the light reflects it, really it says, I'm here. Hello. You know, I'm not camouflaged. I'm here. So I was like, oh, my gosh, who's making these policies up? So I started really looking at the statistics because I ended up getting my master's degree in the career course, which was in public policy and administration. So I'm starting to watch these numbers, and I'm starting to see, you know, what's going on, who's being court-martialed, what was the foundation for the accusation, you know, was it senior and subordinate, or was it two kids in the chew and somebody crossed the line or whatever. And so statistically back then, 54% were from people that knew somebody, right? It was somebody close and they crossed the line. Now I could quickly see that it wasn't the issue of where your location was. This was about educating the female population about basic life skill sets, identifying situations, how to come up through the ranks as a female. So what we did, you know, I started putting it together and going, okay, we need to start having a program here, talking to the women. Senior female leaders need to be talking to the junior female service members on what's acceptable and what's not in the military, and give them insight on not putting themselves in a situation or recognizing a situation and about face and move out. And so there was a lot of opposition that came up, but I just kept plowing through. I knew that's what I was called to do. So we started, and I started having conferences. Even though I'd be told no somewhere, I'd find somebody that said yes. And then finally, generals started getting wind of it throughout Iraq. Female colonels and sergeant majors started contacting me and said, hey, I want to help out. And so we just started flying all over Iraq and conducting what we call Finding Your Voice conferences. And it would be a whole day, and it would start off with senior female leaders talking to the junior female service members. And by the end of the day, what everybody's seeing was just another woman wearing the uniform. And so it was pretty, pretty powerful.
How bad was the problem? You said you did a lot of research. How bad was it?
Well, they said, you know, one's too many.
One, absolutely. But I mean, statistically, people need to know.
Yeah. I mean, I could give you the statistics now. I don't have access to that information. I just see the aftermath of what's going on with the suicides and the homeless rates. Yeah. I don't know what the statistics are now. Generally, they say 90% of females are assaulted or harassed before leaving the military, but 90% don't report. Now, how they come up with that figure, I don't know, but I really, honestly, believe that. Because there's something in our path that we've engaged and nobody says nothing. And most females actually, especially back in that time, would not report. Even though they have all the reporting systems, sometimes those women just wanted to talk to another woman that it happened to and see how she handled it and continued moving up through the ranks. Because a lot of women that serve in the military may be a single parent. And that may be their only support for their children, right? Because it's a good life for kids if it, you know, done appropriately. So sometimes they just wanted to talk to women that had been there before. And that's why it's called In Her Boots, because there wasn't a person on our team that could not relate to somebody.
So when did you really start to ramp it up? When you finally got the name and... When did that was that after you retired? Obviously,
we did this all in Iraq, and I knew it was good. And I'll read you this real quick. I got an email after one of our conferences when I was in Iraq, and the female said, it was a private Brady. She said, thank you so much for everything you are doing with this conference. I think it's not only an important cause, but essential for the well-being of women in the military. I found your conference to be both informative and inspiring. To see so many successful, wonderful women stand up and share very personal encounters was eye-opening. I never realized how many women endured the same struggle in the military. I think this program has the potential to change the way women are viewed in the military, and more importantly, how women view themselves. Finding your voice is a fantastic slogan for what you are doing. It empowers women to make their own decisions and do the right thing. The diversity in the group is also a great thing. I felt like any female in the audience could relate to at least one woman in the conference. And that's from Private Brady.
That's fantastic.
And that's when I knew, this is what we got to be doing. So we did it all in Iraq. And we returned back to Fort Hood because that's where I was out of with the Marine Corps. And that's when the challenges started on, you know, I came off the plane and right there on the tarmac, there was a soldier there going, ma'am, we know exactly who you are. And they were from the SHARP program. And I was like, okay. And so that's when I started getting called in by generals. And they loved me being, I was chief of troop construction for all of Fort Hood. And they loved that. But they didn't want to grasp the program. They didn't want me talking to women. I don't know what the actual deal was. I had one general pull me in and say, Lisa, I watched you go rogue in Iraq, and you're not going rogue in my post. And after a year trying to brief commands on what this program was about, I just finally told the CG and the chief of staff, I said, you know what, gentlemen, I'll retire. I own my own construction company. I got 20 years in the military, but I'll be back. Because what thing they were trying to hold over was if anybody had said to me in the conferences or in our monthly group meetings that they had been assaulted, as long as I was in uniform, then I had an obligation to report. And I told them I wasn't going to, because if a female wanted to report, she would have reported, because she knows how to report. Sometimes they just wanted to talk. So
I think you said it well, that one is too many. And I love the fact that you saw that there was a need and just went rogue and went out and saw that there was a need for prevention as well as recovery and giving women a voice. And I see that you have a grant and you have the Find Your Voice book coming out in September.
Yes.
That's amazing.
And we were going to do it, you know, we were going to focus on one, but as we see the impacts from the veteran population, we're like, oh, more and more needs to be said. Because, you know, as far as our leadership in the Task Force SASA, I mean, we were in command positions or, you know, at the end of our careers, we're not going to see what all's down going on in the motor pool. You know, we were there. And I love that I only made it to major. I mean, I was up for colonel. I was, they selected me for ILE to continue going on. And I was like, you know, I had to make a decision, you know, do I continue on with my career and they keep telling me to sit down and shut up? Or do I just go ahead and retire now and continue on with the mission that's in my heart? And I made that decision to go ahead and retire. But I love the fact that I did make it to major because I was high enough in the command to have a voice, mm-hmm. you know, be able to talk to generals. But I was low enough still that I wasn't so far removed from a private to know what was really going on in her world. Yeah. And I'm thankful that I was there.
That's amazing.
At that position. With the veteran population, we see more and more what's going on. More and more women are speaking up after the fact. Mm. And so we're taking a lot away from that.
So what does that program look like now, and how can someone support?
So right now what the program looks like, so that was in 2012 when I retired. So we're re-engaging through the VA because the VA is apparently going to start a mission where they're voicing their concerns to the Department of Defense on what needs to be done on active duty. So we're trying to use our influence with the VA because we forecasted in 2012 the impacts what was going to happen if the program or something other than death by PowerPoint for your monthly meetings or whatever, mm-hmm. Needs to be done. The VA is now taking a look to influence. So we're trying to use the VA to say, hey, use us or let us come in as consultants or, you know, let us implement the program and we'll train senior leaders at each post to be able to do that. From the veteran side, we do a recovery. And so that's where we've been mostly focused on right now. And so what we do is we help them with the victim impact statements that they're going to need to file a claim, and we help them set up their claim. We notice in the VA, your VSOs, they'll write MST. Well, MST is not a disability, it's an event. And so we see that, and so therefore the females or males are not getting the appropriate disability rating and the help that they need. So we're their advocate. We say watch your lane and your lane only, and we set them up on targets. And their targets are like their goals, but we coach them through on setting them up. So it goes first from, you know, target setting, and then it goes with that claim, because their claims are just going to get them benefits. A lot of it's financial. But the bottom line is we want to make sure they're healed and they're recovering. So immediately we make sure they're getting the right counseling to be able to be healed, because what we're seeing is in a recovery from a sexual assault, you go through stages, and most folks get stuck in a stage and they start this cycle and things keep happening. And what we'll do is take their timeline from their military when the assault happened and the impacts, and we literally chart it out for them. And when they're able to visibly see what is going on after that impact, it just registers. And I can see when they're stuck. And when I show them, they just literally, every one of them start crying because it's like it's visible to them. Mm. And so we get them on that path to healing. From the next part, you know, most people, and this is what goes on in the program too. If you're focused on the buzzword, as they say, your purpose, right? If you're focused on your lane and what you need to be doing, most of the time you're not going to be in those positions where people just cross the line for sexual assault. So if we can deter that at any point, when people retire or get out of the military, they already got baggage because they didn't heal. And then they're like, man, you know, nobody's there to provide me purpose, motivation, and direction. You know, that key word, leadership. That's what we try to do, and we show them, we'll give them a series of tests and to get them on their lane, to identify their lane. Mm. And now they start, after healing, now they can focus on what they're going to do in life. And if we set them up like that, you know, in the program, in the military also, then we're going to reduce the impact on the VA, because folks have already set themselves up in the military to depart, because it's not a matter of if you take off the uniform, it's when you take off the uniform, and you want to be better prepared. Yeah. So we want to make sure the healing, we want to prevent, but in the recovery, that the healing's got to happen there, because what happens, most women will get out of the military and you can recover and still have a very successful career. And that's what we show in the Inner Boots program.
That's awesome. So let's back up there. How do they get in touch with that again? And for more information and direct contact, how do they do that, Lisa?
Okay, they can contact me at Lisa at Tango Foxtrot Sierra Alpha Sierra Alpha .com.
Okay. Is there a phone number or?
Yes. 214-244-1791. And if there's no answer, please, please leave a voicemail.
And do you have a Facebook group and a website?
We do. So if you go on the Facebook, it's In Her Boots program, and the website's innerboots.org or .us.
And all the sales of the jewelry that is in that program, and I have seen, it's awesome looking jewelry. The boots are well done, and all the sales go to right into that program?
Right. The proceeds from the Combat Boots jewelry go into the Inner Boots program. We are not a nonprofit, working on that. So right now we essentially work for free time because we believe in no soldier left behind. It wasn't created to be a reaction, but and we still don't want to do that. But there's healing and there's too many hurting people out there. So something needs to be done. And we just bring a different gift that other, and we support other nonprofits. Anybody that's out there to help, you know, we go in and support. There's a lot that I've been partnering with on doing combat boots, jewelry display. So a lot of them have fashion shows and I'll show up and then end up, I'll get clients from there. So the combat boots jewelry can be found at combatbootsjewelry.com or on Facebook, combat boots jewelry. And it was actually created to, you know, quietly represent that we wore the boots too. Not all professionals wear t-shirts or a hat or lanyards. And so with the jewelry, you're able to quietly represent. And it also, it's a, you know, it's a symbol of a shared experience. And what I find is some of those, the female veterans, they don't talk. Women do not reach out and just go out and talk to somebody. But ironically, when they see another woman wearing the boots, they go, hey, you were a veteran too? And they make that connection. And that may be that connection that that woman needed at that time, you know? And so that's what we see happening. Now, my brother-in-arms have said, hey, we want something too. So there are cufflinks and tie tacks and lapel pins and necklaces for the brothers also. So,
but that's great.
But the jewelry's actually, you know, to represent that you wore the boots too.
That is awesome work, you know, badly needed. And what I like, the approach that you've used, Lisa, is the dignity and the respect and allowing these young ladies in dire situations that have been through something to have a voice and know that there's a sisterhood out there of women that have worn the uniform and may have gone through similar events. And what I hear is, you know, letting them know that they're not alone and they do have a place that they can go, that they can be heard. And, you know, I commend you for it. I hold you in high admiration. And I know that you've helped hundreds, if not thousands, of women everywhere that have worn the uniform and have found themselves in those places. So God bless you. Mm-hmm. Thank you for that. And
I second that as well. You have an incredible mission there. So how can we support you, or somebody who's listening, how can they support you?
Well, actually right now through the jewelry purchase and getting the word out, and I guess that keep on, you know, hey, active duty, you know, any kind of forum with the senior leadership on making those decisions that, hey, something needs to be done on active duty differently, you know, than what you're doing. Because, you know, doing the same thing and wanting a different reaction's insanity. So, right. You know, that there is a program out here. And we're talking senior leaderships. My business partner, Colonel Janice Dombey, she came in and became my boss in Iraq. And I never really worked with females like that, and she hadn't either, so it was kind of comical. Well, now here you got two females. What was more comical was for the male soldiers, you know, when, you know, a lieutenant or a captain would yell, ma'am, and we both would answer, and they'd be like, and we would joke, well, I'm not used to working with another female. And so, but I had to brief her because I was doing this before she came on board in Iraq, and she loved what I was doing. And so we ended up, when we retired, we incorporated. She was actually looked at to be the first female engineer general for the Corps of Engineers.
Wow. Fantastic.
So you've got a lot of, you know, this, and she served 34 years. So we have a lot of experience. This is not just somebody who, you know, we know what it's like to be in her boots.
Absolutely.
Thanks.
You know, and it stands out too that you're still serving, and I think that's another message. There's so many messages that you're, you know, and what you have to say and what y'all are doing. You know, you're still serving. You know, you wear the uniform, but you'll always serve. It's part of who you are. Again, can't say enough. Whatever we can do to help, spread the word and to let people know about the great work that you're doing to help ladies and the men too. So, thank you for that. And I just know that Nina, I know the way she is, and we're just glad you're here, and thank you for the work that you do.
Oh, thank you. Once a soldier, always a soldier.
Can't say it enough, and I just look forward to the next time we see you. We had a blast in Dallas. You were there at the Military Influencers Conference, and you're definitely making an influence. You're keeping us proud. So thank you very much, ma'am. I appreciate it, and I hope to see you again.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you, Lisa. It was an honor to be on here with you.
Thank you.
Before they burn it down, you better dig deep, put them in the ground. But on their hands, yeah, they're hellbound. Sing a song.